Tunisia, are languages currently spoken that appear to lack any hierarchical grammar. Their grammars are little more than words arranged like beads on a string, rather than structured as chunks within chunks. Second, there is a good deal of evidence that symbols evolved long before grammar in human linguistic history. Third, hierarchical grammars, when they are found, are little more than byproducts. There are independent processing advantages of hierarchy well known in the computer science community, as Herbert Simon said. Hierarchical organization aids tremendously in the processing and retrieval of any kind of information, not merely the information found in human languages. A fourth reason to reject the idea that any one type of structure is central to language is that non-human creatures appear to use syntax. But if this is true, ability to learn syntax is not exclusive to humans. Animals that use some form of linguistic structure include Alex the parrot and Coco the gorilla. Their syntax is neither clearly hierarchical nor recursive, but they nonetheless employ structure-based understanding. Fifth, humans have evolved away from cognitive rigidity. Animals need instincts because they lack flexible cognition. But this is the opposite of the direction that human evolution has taken towards language and cognitive flexibility rather than instinct-driven behavior as found among other animals. What humans know and learn is based on local cultural and even environmental constraints. They are free to develop very different, non-genetically programmed structures. Similarities found across the world's languages would tell us about how human communication works, not about human evolution or hardwiring of human language instincts. What did Homo erectus invent then? Symbols. And symbols are just a short hop away from language. Over time, the form and meaning units of erectus would have been ordered and perhaps structured, eventually producing ever more advanced structures, as in modern languages. But how did humans do this when other creatures did not? The answer is easy. All of human invention and language is underwritten, shaped, and enhanced by the human brain. And, in fair play, language paid its debt to the brain by helping the brain become more intelligent, placing cultural and sexual selection pressures on humans to communicate better. The evidence thus strongly supports the claim that Homo erectus possessed language, evidence of culture, values, knowledge structures, and social organization, tool use and improvement, however slowly compared to Homo sapiens, exploration of the land and sea, going beyond what could be seen to what could be imagined, and symbols in the forms of decorations and tools. Only language is able to explain the Homo erectus cognitive revolution. Language evolved relatively rapidly after the appearance of the first symbols. But as the benefits of hominin communication grew, so did the evolutionary pressures to produce clearer sounds, longer discourses, and more involved conversations. The story of the evolution of human language cannot be told fully without understanding how hominins evolved physiologically to support more complex and more efficient communication. For this reason, we need to talk a bit about the evolution of our brains and vocal abilities. Part 2. Human Biological Adaptations for Language. 5. Humans get a better brain. Scarecrow. Do you think if I went with you, this wizard would give me some brains? Dorothy. I couldn't say. But even if he didn't, you'd be no worse off than you are now.
Scarecrow.
Yes, that's true.
The Wizard of Oz.
If Scarecrow weren't a fictional character, he couldn't have been simultaneously brainless and loquacious. Humans, of course, would not be able to engage in conversations without a brain. But one doubts that the poor fictional Scarecrow understood what he was asking for. If he could talk without a brain, he was probably better off. This is because while brains are indeed the source of love, of sharing, of music and of beauty, of science and art, they are also the origins of terrorism, bigotry, war, and machismo. The brain is simultaneously the reason for our greatest accomplishments and the source of our greatest failures as a species. But evolution doesn't care about success or failure in the cultural sense, and it certainly doesn't care directly about evil or beauty. Evolution is about the physical survival of the fittest. The hominin brain grew and developed for over 7 million years, from Sahelanthropus chadensis to Homo sapiens about 200,000 years ago. Then the growth and development seems to have stopped. There has been no clear evidence for evolution in Homo brain size since sapiens first left Africa. If Homo sapiens were smarter than Homo erectus and Homo neanderthalensis 200 millennia ago, why are humans no smarter today than those sapiens that first left Africa, as the evidence suggests? This could be due to any number of factors. It may be that there hasn't been enough time for the brain to have evolved since sapiens first appeared. 200,000 years is a short period of time in the sweep of evolutionary history. On the other hand, according to some theories, Homo neanderthalensis emerged from Homo heidelbergensis in only 100,000 years. An alternative theory, the Great Leap Forward theory, suggests that change has occurred in the last 50,000 years, due to the appearance of art and leaps in cultural evolution. But there is no compelling reason to suppose that this change in the archaeological record is the result of biological evolution. Cultural development and new experiences could have built up slowly, finally leading to breakthroughs that would have seemed miraculous to earlier generations, such as the 19th century Industrial Revolution. This is a time period long enough to have produced at least two or three such great leaps, in principle. So why is it that there seems to be no significant change in the brain for the past 200 millennia? This apparent halt in human brain development is nothing to be ashamed of. It seems to be caused by the simple fact that life is good for our species. Homo sapiens have exploited a planet of plenty through agriculture and technology, enjoying survival rates and quality of life that no other species has ever known. No other creature since time began has ridden the crest of the evolutionary wave as sapiens has, not even our human predecessors. Erectus and Neanderthalensis never achieved cultural levels at which they could benefit from dentistry, science, relatively advanced medicine. They lacked the cultural resources to live with high mental and physical health and well-being. They lacked the intense innovation of sapiens. Was this the result of language? Did Homo sapiens have better language skills and, therefore, greater cultural accomplishments? The answer is, it's complicated. Language is not that difficult, in spite of a long tradition going back to the 1950s telling us that it is extremely complicated, a veritable mystery. What we have seen, to the contrary, is that language is symbols and ordering at its core, and those are not tough ingredients to develop for brains like ours. On the other hand, having something to talk about can be hard, and that depends on both culture and individual intelligence. As Homo brains evolved and our intelligence as a species grew, it isn't so much that language improved, but our ability to use it did. Smarter people can put the same tool to better use. And, yes, they can improve it. But the crucial thing here is the intelligence that our larger brains gave us over Erectus to think even more abstractly and to take the symbolism our Erectus ancestors had given us and project this into art and our stories, into cool technology, and so on. The combination of language and greater intelligence, accumulating knowledge over time, would have been all that was needed to result eventually in the second cognition revolution of 1,000 centuries ago, as sapiens emerged from Africa. This greater intelligence, as well as growing relative geographical rootedness found in anatomically modern humans, such as Cro-Magnon, early sapiens in Europe, would have allowed them to construct more intricate cultures through greater social specialization. Hunter-gatherer societies are often perfect examples of political anarchy, in the sense that they have no political structure other than group consensus. That has its attraction. Such societies often lack priests, full-time musicians, carpenters, and all other specialized professions. This is because the cultural challenges accepted by hunter-gatherers, what they think is worthwhile, what their environment allows them to do, how they have chosen to live their lives, simply afford little opportunity for specialization. Specialization requires a society to provide food or goods to members who produce non-food-related services or goods for the society. If someone spends all day playing a musical instrument to make someone else feel happy, they are going to need some food when they're done. But if no one gives them any, their music will stop while they plant a field instead of playing or singing. Language-enabled culture is the glue that holds the human cognitive colony together. Once again, therefore, it is simplistic to suppose, as many researchers appear to, that the dramatically more complex cultural artifacts and social organization of Homo sapiens relative to Erectus or Neanderthalensis are the result of language alone. Sapiens quite possibly have greater vocabularies and more complex grammars than other species of Homo had. The sapiens' brain is better. But more importantly, sapiens' cultures and histories are richer. Sapiens have inherited much from other Homo species. They have incorporated ancient wisdom into sapiens' cultures, languages, and thinking. These accretions are in addition to all of the original developments, physical and cultural, by sapiens since they emerged from other species. Language has, of course, changed in the Homo genus over the past 1.9 million years or so, but a great deal of Homo biology has also changed. Erectus and others developed differently from the way in which we do. Biological anthropologists have written on the different life histories of Homo species. Sapiens developed more slowly than their Homo ancestors. Some of the life history distinctions between Homo species and other primates include longer pregnancies, longer periods of growth. Sapiens infancy is longer. Sapiens adolescence is longer. Sapiens adulthood is longer than any other primate, including, apparently, Neanderthalensis and Erectus. Humans have to live more slowly in order to live longer. This is common in the animal kingdom. Slower growth usually means longer lives. Human biology confuses this simple picture a tad, however, because humans have very short periods between births, usually a feature of shorter-lived creatures. In this respect, humans are a cross between whales and rabbits. If life history, brain growth, and more nurturing as a result from parents, other kin, and the culture at large also characterized part of the contrast between sapiens and, say, erectus, then these non-linguistic facts, already independently established in studies of biological anthropologists, could explain a great deal about the larger culture and linguistic development of sapiens other than language. While there is nothing in the archaeological record to suggest that erectus lacked language, there is evidence that erectus were not as intelligent as sapiens, and that they developed differently. But these points should not be confused. Homo species, including erectus, demonstrate several stages of brain evolution. By examining these stages, we get some idea of the advantages later species enjoyed over earlier ones. Paleoanthropologist Ralph Holloway and his colleagues proposed four major stages of hominin brain evolution based on years of research and study of the fossil record. Stage zero is the foundational stage, beginning with the split between chimpanzees and hominins. This stage extends back in time to Sahelanthropus, Ardipithecus, and Aurorin, roughly 6 to 8 million years ago, when brains were marked by three characteristics that distinguished them from their descendants. First, the lunate sulcus, crescent or moon-shaped groove in the brain, of these creatures is found further towards the front, anterior, portion of the brain. This groove divides the visual cortex from the frontal cortex. Since it is known that the frontal cortex of the brain is required for thinking, then, other things being equal, the larger this portion of the cortex, the better one can think. The position of the lunate sulcus is indicative of the relative thinking sophistication of the brain it is found in. Therefore, the further back the lunate sulcus is found, the reasoning goes, the more intelligent the animal. Second, Sahelanthropus, in all probability, had a less developed part of the brain dedicated to connecting multiple cerebral components. This portion is called the posterior association cortex. This area of the brain links multiple regions simultaneously, enabling faster thinking. The posterior association cortex lets us bring several parts of our brains to bear on a single problem simultaneously. Finally, the brains of the first hominins were small, 350 to 450 cubic centimeters on average. This likely means that their smaller and more simply organized brains would have been incapable of anything like modern human thought. The next phase, Holloway's stage one of hominin brain evolution, began about 3.5 million years ago with the appearance of Australopithecus africanus and afarensis. The lunate sulcus in these creatures has moved a bit further back relative to its position in earlier hominins. This is known because of impressions of the interior of their fossil skulls, endocasts. The visual cortex of the Australopithecines had shrunk, while their frontal cortex was now larger. Cognition was building steam. The posterior association cortex is also larger in Australopithecines. Their overall brains show signs of reorganization, and more specialized areas are becoming evident, along with an expansion in size to around 500 cubic centimeters. Australopithecus cerebrums, the brain just under the cortex, show signs of asymmetry, with the left and right hemispheres taking on different specializations. In modern humans, this is very pronounced, leading to somewhat romanticized claims about left-brained versus right-brained personalities. Hominin brain's next evolutionary jump occurs about 1.9 million years ago with the appearance of Homo erectus. By this time, the hominin brain had gotten much larger and specialized, an unparalleled combination of cognitive firepower. Nothing had been seen like this in the 4 billion years of evolution prior to the appearance of Homo. This coincides with stage 2 in Holloway's scheme, marked by an overall increase in brain volume and encephalization, accompanied by modern sapiens-like asymmetries, such as between left hemisphere for language and hearing from the right ear versus right hemisphere for hearing from the left ear, and so on. At this stage, brains began to exhibit a prominent region around Broca's area, important for sequential actions. They also probably had better language abilities. There would have also have been increased development after birth of each sapiens and improved social learning in areas such as tool-making, hunting, and so on. In stage 3, Holloway's final stage that occurred about 500,000 years ago, the brain had reached its maximal size and refinement in specialization for each hemisphere. Therefore, Homo erectus arrived on the scene with brain asymmetries typical of modern humans, such as a well-developed Broca's region. This implies the existence of, or at least the possibility for, some form of language. This is not a surprise, of course, since apart from directly looking at the brain of erectus, there is evidence from their cultural accomplishments that they had language. These features of the early Homo brain mean, too, that Homo infants took longer to reach full maturity, since brain cells require the longest time to mature. It can therefore be inferred from these changes that erectus was capable of social learning in hunting, collecting, scavenging, and reproductive strategies. Now, it is important to avoid giving the wrong impression. Erectus was not the equal of Homo sapiens. In fact, compared to sapiens, they had many, many shortcomings. It is important to discuss a few of the ways Erectus, for all of their relative brilliance, were inferior to sapiens. First, their speech may not have carried over long distances. This is a result of their inability to form the same range of vowels that sapiens can produce. In all likelihood, their vowels would have been hard to pick up across distances. On the other hand, like the Pirihas and other groups, it is possible that Erectus was able to overcome this shortcoming by simple yelling combined with distinctive pitch patterns. In either case, the fact that their speech would not have carried far doesn't mean that they did not have language. Erectus' speech perhaps sounded more garbled relative to that of sapiens, making it harder to hear the differences between words. This could have entailed less efficient communication than modern humans enjoy, but it would not mean that they lacked language. The existence of ambiguity, homonyms, confusion, and the importance of context to interpret what someone has said to someone else continues to be crucial to modern speech. Part of the reason for Erectus's probably mushy speech is that they lacked a modern hyoid, Greek for U-shaped, bone, the small bone in the pharynx that anchors the larynx. The muscles that connect the hyoid to the larynx use their hyoid anchor to raise and lower the larynx and produce a wider variety of speech sounds. The hyoid bone of Erectus was shaped more like the hyoid bones of the other great apes, and had not yet taken on the shape of sapiens and Neanderthalensis's hyoids, these two being virtually identical. The non-modern Erectus hyoid bone has profound implications for the evolution of speech and language. These were not the only differences between Erectus and other Homo species. Erectus' faces were more distinguished by prognathism than modern humans, which would have impeded speech as we know it, though prognathism would not have blocked their speech. Behind these physical differences were genetic differences between Erectus and sapiens. The FOXP2 gene, though it is not a gene for language, has important consequences for human cognition and control of the muscles used in speech. This gene seems to have evolved in humans since the time of Erectus. FOXP2 gives greater speech control. Possessing a more primitive FOXP2 gene, Erectus would have had less laryngeal and therefore less emotional control in their speech. FOXP2 also elongates neurons and makes cognition faster and more effective. Without this, Erectus would certainly have been duller than modern humans. But this is not a surprise. Such a FOXP2 difference could have resulted in a lack of parallel processing of language by Erectus, another reason they would have thought more slowly. FOXP2 in modern humans also increases length and synaptic plasticity of the basal ganglia, aiding motor learning and performance of complex tasks. It is also unclear, therefore, whether Erectus enjoyed the same degree of cognitive plasticity as we do. It is probable that Erectus was a dull, non-inventive creature compared to modern humans. That doesn't mean that it was a languageless creature. Erectus was, at the time, the smartest entity ever to have lived, just not as smart as sapiens turned out to be. The difference in intelligence might have been great, or it might have been less than their brain size would indicate. There is much here that we do not know. Supporting the idea of a less well-developed intellect for Erectus, its most common tools were more similar in some respects to the tools of earlier non-Homo primates. Erectus's simplest tools may have been more homogeneous and non-combinatory, not built from multiple parts, handleless axes versus axes with handles, for example. On the other hand, the earliest evidence for complex tools predates sapiens. These were hafted spears and were created by Homo erectus, or one of its descendants, if a finer splitting of Homo species is preferred. And of course, there are also the watercraft that Erectus used to cross significant distances in the ocean, which can only be classified as complex tools. Thus, the archaeological record, while showing no complex stone tools, provides indirect evidence that Erectus did in fact make complex tools of other materials. To repeat, theories based on stone tools often omit evidence from non-stone tools. Paleoanthropologist John Shea argues for a tight connection between technology and language, explaining that they are structured similarly in certain ways, though basing his work nearly exclusively on stone tools. This is understandable, to a degree, of course, because stone tools are the only tools still available for direct study. And it may very well be true that if Erectus had simpler technology, then they would have also have had a simpler language. This is not at all clear, however. Looking exclusively at stone tools is insufficient. It does not follow that simpler tools imply a lack of language or even a qualitatively different kind of language. Some paleoanthropologists appear to conflate complex tool-making with complex syntax by not being fully aware of the enormous variation among modern languages in this regard, some with complex etymological tools, but syntax that is less complex, perhaps, than those tools would suggest. Culture and biology together explain the apparent absence of ongoing extensive brain evolution among Homo sapiens. Sapiens seem to have passed a threshold of complexity that allows them to take care of themselves so well that they simply no longer have the same need for evolutionary assistance as they once did. As already discussed, this could come from different life histories in sapiens, cumulative cultural knowledge, language developed over time, and differently powered brains. Modern humans live, survive, and produce viable offspring because of culture. This is not to say that there is no microevolution going on in modern humans. There could be humans with brains that are different from those of other humans in ways that produce greater numbers of viable offspring. But there is no evidence that brains are becoming larger or more specialized across sapiens, either currently or since the beginning of this species. Neither is there a claim that sapiens' brains could not evolve to someday make humans incomparably smarter than humans are today. One can imagine creatures with much higher intelligence, on average, than Homo sapiens. But evolution is not trying to build a brainiac. It is concerned merely with building a creature that is just good enough to have viable offspring. And there is another thing. The only way natural selection can make people smarter is if more intelligent people have more offspring that live. But culture changes everything. Across the globe, cultures care for their members more effectively than at any time in human history. Cultural welfare has come to vie with physical evolutionary pressures in the definition of humans' evolutionary niche. Culture has also created a niche that is no longer purely biological, altering the course of evolution as new cultural pressures arise and traditional biological pressures become comparatively less significant. Individuals who would have perhaps failed to survive without the level of cultural support available to modern humans are now able to transmit their genes to viable offspring. It may be that physically weaker or congenitally infirm individuals have no evolutionary disadvantage in the environment of a nurturing culture. This is good for humans because cultural niches change, which favors increased diversity in the species, spawning ever more nurturing cultures, accelerating the change and survivability of those who, at one time, may not have survived. Eugenics advocated the improvement of human genetic heritage, but by failing to recognize the power of culture in shaping our evolution, eugenics had it wrong. Culture not only is the key to improving the species and the survivability of all, but also has liberated us from the strictly biological. Humans arrived at this place of cortical stability through changes that might surprise some. They responded creatively and culturally to challenges of safety, travel, climate, shelter, and food. As we learned earlier, they learned to cook food, which in turn helped them to eat more meat, which helped to shrink their guts. Repeating then, calories that were once used for digestion were then freed up for Homo's brains. The result is modern brains and bodies, improved human thinking, morality, and emotional control. This evolutionary progression reveals as clearly as anything the interrelatedness of organs and the embodiment of the brain in the body as a holistic apparatus. Human brains are smarter when our intestines are smaller. From erectus to sapiens, humans are, in a sense, self-made, pulling themselves along both the evolutionary and linguistic trails by their bootstraps. Erectus began the long process for humans of thinking their way to the modern world. Looking back on the course of human brain and cultural evolution, there are major discoveries, accelerated cultural evolution, and long periods of stagnation among early humans. Following the rise of Homo sapiens, profound innovations appear, along with a much faster rate of cultural change. This is why it is appropriate to refer to the Homo sapiens era, relative to that of other Homo species, as the Age of Innovation. The innovation of Homo sapiens, greater than that of any other species, increased exponentially with the beginning of agricultural economies around 10,000 years ago on, arguably, opposite sides of the globe, in both Sumeria and Guatemala. Even before the rise of agriculture, however, innovations seemed to occur after species reached both cerebral and cultural thresholds. But an age, whether of invention, imitation, or iron tools, does not characterize its entire population. In the Iron Age, people still used wooden tools, and in our present age of innovation, most Homo sapiens do not innovate in any significant way. To learn about the brains of humans and how they underwrite language from several sources, one must turn to neurology, paleoneurology, archaeology, linguistics, and anthropology. One must learn through clinical and neuroscientific studies of neurodiversity from people with disorders such as specific language impairment, SLI, aphasia, or autistic spectrum disorder, ASD. And humans need to compare their brains with those of earlier great apes. As Erectus learned first, no brain is an island. Human brains are networked. First, their brains are networked in their bodies, connected evolutionarily and physiologically to other organs. But equally importantly, their brains are networked to other brains. As philosopher Andy Clark has claimed for years, culture supersizes our brains. A brain is an organ connected to other brain organs in a sea of culture. This is a point worth emphasizing. In fact, one cannot understand the role of the brain in language and evolution without this conception. It is why caution must be exercised before accepting the popular but very misleading idea that the brain is a computer, an artifact very unlike an organ. Indeed, computers lack culture. The question to ask, rather, is how do the anatomy, functioning, and overall architecture of the brain help us to understand the role of the brain in the body, one organ among many? And how does culture help us to understand the brain as part of a social network of brains? And finally, the $64,000 question for our purposes, what does a brain have to be like for its owner to have language? The best conclusion is that the brain is a general-purpose organ evolved for fast and flexible thinking. It has to be prepared for anything. And for that very reason, it is freer of instincts, or any other form of pre-specified knowledge, than other species. Humans are fortunate that natural selection widened, rather than narrowed, their cognitive options. This freedom illumines our use and possession of natural language and other advanced cognitive abilities. However, when we lose any of that freedom through different cognitive or speech disorders, the nature of our brains is revealed more clearly. This is why it is necessary to examine carefully breakdowns of the ability to engage in normal linguistic activity. Language deficits such as these might interfere with normal participation in a conversation, composing or understanding sentences, or being able to use the right words in the right context. Surprisingly, what emerges from such study is that there is little evidence that human brains have genetically specialized tissue for language. This perhaps startling assertion is supported by the fact that there is no convincing evidence to date that there are specifically heritable linguistic deficits. Language deficits are rooted in other physical or mental problems. This may come as a surprise, although it would be perhaps more unexpected to learn that there was tissue, or neuronal networks specialized for language, since language results from human neuroplasticity, which is in part the ability of neurons to change to better fit the needs of their containing organism. And there is, of course, also synaptic plasticity, the ability of connections, synapses, between neurons to alter as humans learn, grow, or suffer brain damage. And not just humans. It has been discovered that if the third digit of an owl monkey is amputated, a gruesome experimentation that I hope will be halted, then changes happen in the brain of the monkey. The brain of the owl monkey has distinct areas for each digit. Following amputation, the area associated with the amputated digit will be overrun by other brain functions. In other words, the owl monkey's brain is flexible. Human brains are even more so. Brains don't let perfectly good neurons stand idle if they are needed for something else. Like Arnold Schwarzenegger in The Terminator, human brains rewire around damaged areas and repurpose undamaged areas that are no longer needed for their original functions. Human brains also undergo a tremendous amount of synaptic change during a lifetime. Brains literally change, adding more connections, thus more white matter, in response to learning, to adapt to new cultural environments or pathology, such as brain damage. Synaptic pruning and the establishment of novel synaptic connections in the brain are particularly robust features of human brain development before puberty, leading to the naming of this period of human development and learning as the critical period. It isn't clear whether this stage is as crucial in theories of cognition, such as language learning, as is sometimes claimed, but it is certainly an important segment of human cognitive development and neuroplasticity. As mentioned earlier, the brain is not a computer. It is important to underscore this again in the present context, because it is a core belief for many linguists, cognitive scientists, and computer scientists. The desire to see the brain as a machine goes all the way back to Galileo's analogy of the universe as a clock. The appeal of this analogy is obvious, since both a computer and a brain handle information. But conceiving of a biological organ, whether a brain or a heart, as a computer is an impediment to understanding either. To take one example, the brain does not appear to be organized into separate modules, or working units, for different functions in the way computers are. Additionally, the brain evolved without intervention. It is biological. A common reply to this is that it doesn't matter what the computer is made of, only what it does and how it does it. And yet, the biological stuff from which the brain is made cannot live apart from its interaction with biological tissue and liquids that link it as part of a system with its vital non-computational functions, such as love. One could build a computer from human neurons, but it still would not be a brain. Unlike a computer, it does matter what a brain is built of and where it is housed. Now, one might reply that a computer is also part of a network, plugged into a power grid and connected to other computers and so on. But neurology is ultimately not the same kind of thing as electronics. Computers lack biological functions, emotions, and culture. Another difference is that computers do nothing unless they are running a program. While brains do not literally have software, there are those who attribute something like software, a bioprogram, to account for language learning. But that metaphor has failed to produce answers to the kinds of questions and facts encountered in the story of human evolution. There is just no source of conceptual content inborn in all humans. Concepts are never inborn. They are learned. As Aristotle put it, paraphrased by Aquinas, nihil est in intellectu quod non sit prius in sensu. Nothing is in the intellect that was not first in the senses. On the other hand, perceptual abilities, seeing, hearing, feeling, tasting, and certain emotions such as fear, do seem to be inborn. This kind of innate physical predisposition is drawn upon in language acquisition and cultural evolution. Some people use vision more than hearing when gathering data. Humans' emotional need for one another and desire for social interaction favor the development of language. So the brain definitely has specific individual properties. But it is still important to avoid conceiving of the brain as a blastula of specific conceptual regions or a computer or pre-programmed with actual knowledge about anything. One of the reasons that some creatures skipped the handout of brains from the evolutionary deity is energy consumption. Brains are calorifically expensive. The average human brain burns around 325 to 350 calories per day. That is about one-fourth of the average human's daily calorie consumption at rest, 1,300, and about one-eighth of the average active person's requirement of around 2,400 calories per day. In other words, the brain is a high-maintenance piece of equipment. As specialists on the evolution of human fat consumption have observed, compared to other primates and mammals of our size, humans allocate a much larger share of their daily energy budget to feed their brains. The disproportionately large allocation of our energy budget to brain metabolism has important implications for our dietary needs. To accommodate the high energy demands of our large brains, humans consume diets that are of much higher quality, that is, more dense in energy and fat, than those of our primate kin. On average, we consume higher levels of dietary fat than other primates, and much higher levels of key long-chain polyunsaturated fatty acids, LCPUFAs, that are critical to brain development. Beyond calorie consumption, another reason to lack a brain is redundancy. Parasites can live in human guts without needing to think, ingesting whatever comes their way because of the brain-guided decisions of their hosts. They don't need brains because they use ours. Why waste resources? A final reason for lacking a brain is the absence of the correct evolutionary history. For humans, this history was more complicated than for any other animal. Human brains, bodies, and cultures have all evolved over the past 2 million years in a grand symbiosis. The body, including the brain, is connected to culture as hummingbirds are to flower pollination. Human bodies and brains are enhanced by culture, just as culture itself is enhanced by our thinking and language. Ever since Franz Boas, one of the founding figures of North American anthropology, it has been known that culture can affect body size, the use of language, what we recognize as talent, along with other aspects of human phenotypes. As noted in Chapter 1, dual inheritance theory, also known as the Baldwin effect, refers to the discovery that culture indirectly affects the genotype itself. Natural selection favors changes in our alleles that produce culturally desirable components of our phenotypes. To summarize what we have learned about brains, humans' larger brains could evolve only by overcoming three major disadvantages. First, it has already been seen that brain tissue is among the most metabolically expensive in the human body. The second problem is that larger brains take longer to mature. Human children are not able to defend, feed, clothe, and shelter themselves for a minimum of 12 years, and sometimes much more, depending on the culture. Finally, the third major disadvantage of larger brains is that there is a conflict in bipeds between the benefits of narrow hips to aid movement and the need for a birth canal large enough to accommodate increasingly larger-brained infants. Big brains can kill mothers in childbirth because the birth canal is small. This is so that the mother can walk, while the brain is large, so that the child can think. This raises the question of how big brains need to be to support human intelligence. Many paleoneurologists use what is called the EQ, or encephalization quotient. This is a ratio of a species' brain size to the average brain size of a mammal with the same body size. The theory behind the EQ is that intelligence grows not so much with the absolute size of the brain. A sperm whale's is around 8,000 cubic centimeters, but with the ratio of the species' brain size to its body size. And this idea does seem to be a fairly reliable predictor. Tom Schurneman from Indiana University has made the case that absolute brain size also matters because it leads to specialization in the brain that smaller brains are unable to achieve. Schurneman lists several advantages to having larger brains for Homo erectus, other members of the genus Homo, and all other creatures. First, highly encephalized species tend to forage or hunt strategically, taking into account the habits of their food or prey, while less encephalized species tend to graze or hunt opportunistically. Further, as brain size increases, different areas of the cortex become less directly connected with each other. The consequence of this changed connectivity is that as brains increase in size, areas are increasingly able to carry out processing independent of other regions. Such independence makes parallel processing increasingly possible, and this has significant consequences because it leads to great sophistication in behavioral response. Susanna Herculano-Huzel, in her 2016 book, The Human Advantage, A New Understanding of How Our Brain Became Remarkable, has made the case that human brains are superior, due in part, to much greater neuronal density. We have more neurons per cubic centimeter overall, and more connections between them. The idea that culture affects behavior, appearance, intelligence, and other aspects of one's phenotype leads to the conclusion that the most important question about our brains is not what in the brain makes language possible. The right question is, how do brains, cultures, and their interactions work together to produce language? The answer is that, over time, each has helped the other to improve. One cannot understand the evolution of language, therefore, without understanding the evolution of the brain. The brain, likewise, cannot be understood without understanding the evolution of culture. The challenge in understanding the evolution of the hominin brain, once hominins diverged from other primates some 6 million years ago, whether via Ardipithecus, Sahelanthropus, or Aurorin, is not only how the human brain got bigger, but why. It is known that the brain grew from the time of Australopithecus from approximately 500 cubic centimeters to nearly 1,300 cubic centimeters, in a relatively short space of 125,000 generations, or 3 million years. To understand why this increase occurred, it is necessary to understand the brains of contemporary Homo sapiens and to work out methods for understanding brain evolution in light of fossil and cultural evidence. There were several changes in the environment that pressured human brains to enlarge in order to support greater intelligence. Fortunately, we know the starting point for these changes to be Australopithecus, and much is known about the end point of hominin evolution, Homo sapiens. It only remains to determine how we got from one to the other. This entails figuring out the stages along the way. It is necessary, therefore, to examine the evidence for brain evolution in the fossil record and changes in the environment that might have exerted selective pressure upon human brain evolution. One aspect of the brain's growth and development, its encephalization, is easy. Creatures with bigger bodies tend to have bigger brains. As fossils indicate an increase in the overall body size of hominins, they also show increases in brain size. The formula seems simple enough. Grow the body, grow the brain. So, did the brain just come along for the ride with the growth of the body? Maybe not. In fact, the relationship of encephalization to body growth may have been the reverse. It is possible that the external pressures leading to the growth of the brain also caused hominins to have larger bodies. Brain size and body size are controlled by some of the same genes. As Mark Grabowski puts it, results suggest that strong selection to increase brain size alone played a large role in both brain and body size increases throughout human evolution, and may have been solely responsible for the major increase in both traits that occurred during the transition from Australopithecus to Homo erectus. This switch in emphasis has major implications for adaptive hypotheses on the origins of our genus. And he continues, "It may simply be that a larger brain requires a larger body to meet its increasing energetic demands, and evolutionary constraints due to brain-body covariation are one way of maintaining this relationship. This all means that the evolution of brain and body size is a chicken-versus-egg problem. Either the brain evolved and brought the body with it, or vice versa. But whichever came first, the enduring question is to understand the pressures that led to growth in human intelligence. I think that the best way to look at the problem is, like so many aspects of biological development and existence, as a case of symbiosis, where two or more creatures or parts of creatures, like brains, developed or evolved in tandem, each needing and affecting the other. Considering, then, the implications of brain anatomy and functioning as part of a human body and culture for the understanding of brain and language evolution, it is worth returning to further discussion of paleoneurology. What one needs to consider, seriously, is what it meant and still means for the understanding of hominin evolution that the human brain grew so quickly and reached such a large size relative to the rest of their bodies. As neurolinguist John Ingram has stated, this represents, in evolutionary time, a runaway growth of the brain. A fascinating discussion on brain size and growth is given by paleoanthropologist Dean Falk, who compares the Tong baby fossil discovered by Raymond Dart to the discovery of the Hobbit, a tiny variety of Homo erectus whose fossils were unearthed on the island of Flores by Australian paleontologists Peter Brown and Michael Morwood. It had been known for some time that Homo erectus lived on Flores and developed a robust cultural outpost some 900,000 years ago. But the Hobbit was unexpected. The first question about them was, why were they so small? Another was, how did they survive so long in coexistence with Homo sapiens? Apparently, the Hobbit had lived until as recently as 18,000 years ago, perhaps even as recently as 14,000 years ago. Since most researchers believed that all non-sapiens species of the genus Homo, aside from Neanderthalensis, had died out roughly 200,000 years ago, This was a shock. The brain of these occupants, now known as Homo floresiensis, was much smaller than that of their erectus ancestors. In fact, floresiensis's brain was smaller than the brain size of many australopithecines, coming in at around 426 cubic centimeters. What does this surprise?